It is time once again for the Post-Prison Education Program Radio Show, and we are joined here live in the KODX studios once again by Ari Cohn, who is president and founder of the Post-Prison Education Program. And Ari, thank you for coming in once again.
Yep.
You're like clockwork. You're the rock that is keeping us going. So it is. It has been another interesting month for many reasons. One, as you had mentioned, at least last month's show, and I think you also mentioned it perhaps on a show the month even prior to that. But Post-Prison Education Program is celebrating 15 years.
Yeah, pretty so cool.
That's. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. Hannah set up a newsletter to our listserv that went out last Sunday, and I think we got it up on our Facebook page, so I think there's a link to it on the program's Facebook page to the newsletter that talks about it. But it was, Taylor Buck... has Kevin Allen, Taylor is our team leader for applicant and student services, and she has, Taylor has Kevin Allen on a panel, a nationwide panel with NAMI, which we're really excited about, and it's super important, in October. And they were asking me about my history with Kevin. And you know, my Outlook archives are pretty extensive. I archive stuff sort of notoriously. And
Outlook being the Microsoft email system.
Yeah. Okay. So so I had forgotten a lot. I mean, I vaguely remembered 2005 when the whole conversation about the program started, but I had forgotten a lot of the specifics. And so I searched my Outlook and found all these emails from 2005 that between Kevin and I, where he was introducing me to a professor named Fer Dario, who introduced me to Emil Petrie, who was vice president of the Office of Minority Affairs at the University of Washington. And it was interesting anyway. It was just because I'd forgotten so much of it. And so when Hannah was... for this newsletter announcing that went out to the listserv announcing the 15th anniversary, she wanted me to write an introductory paragraph or two about the last 15 years. And so I used some of those email that I went and found for Taylor so she would have a good bio for Kevin, and used that to kind of talk about how the program got started. It was really a fluke. Like we've got somebody that works with us who's a Princeton graduate, Crystal, and just took her LSAT today. And I was kind of in that mode, but I had graduated UW and had taken LSAT and was headed for law school. I'd actually flown to Florida and interviewed one law school down there that I liked because they were in the top 10 in litigation. It was a little teeny tiny law school, Stetson University, but they always beat Harvard and all these big name schools in national competitions for litigation, civil rights litigation. So I had applied there and I was invited for an interview. And then there was another comparable school in Sacramento. So I was doing that. I had interviewed at a law school in Philadelphia. And so I was headed for law school. And a professor a block away from here. What, the University of Washington School of Social Works, a block north or a block south? Block south.
South.
Yeah, and she knew me, and she knew my politics, and she suggested I go to this sort of welcome home party for two women and three men coming out of Washington's prison system back to the community. And back then, I used to mentor. I was a big brother to several young people, and big brothers, big sisters, right? And so my Saturday, was with this young man, and I didn't want to break that commitment, but I wanted to go to this welcome home party, and then I went. And Kevin Allen was one of the people that coming out of prison. And what got me was, you know, there's such a stigma about mental illness. It's, I don't think, other than having a history of sex crimes, I don't think there's any, you know, like if you murder somebody, there's no stigma to that at all. Go to prison, do your time, come out, and you can put your life back together. But there's such a stigma about people who suffer mental illness that when I see somebody be courageous to the max, that they're willing to talk publicly about their diagnosis, it always gets my attention. And Kevin was just, that day those men and women could speak or not speak, right? And they weren't going to get much towels, dental floss, you know, just kind of a welcome home thing. And it was at Pocan, when Pocan was in like the 2300 block on South Rainier. And he just spoke eloquently, and he very candidly about, I think back then they were still calling bipolar manic depressive, which I think by far is a better description. But he spoke about that diagnosis, an addiction to crack. And I was just blown away. And I mean, Kevin was on the show with us, remember, a couple months ago, and back pre-COVID when people could come down here to the station without risking their lives. And you know, he's just eloquent and compassionate and loving and soft-spoken and speaks really well. And he just blew me away. So I worked with a nonprofit that did the event that day and made arrangements to take him to breakfast. And he was staying at the Aloha Inn back then. So I picked him up at the Aloha Inn. We went to Julia's Kitchen on Capitol Hill, and for 2 hours I listened to him talk. And I just finished 4 years at UW, and so my mind was really oriented towards education. And I really thought somebody that had comorbidity in their life, you know, addiction and mental illness, probably, I mean, there's a good chance they couldn't put their lives together. Kevin has, by the way, which is extraordinary. And but I thought if anything could, it would be getting him on a college campus. And so I met him, listened to him, wrote Mike McCann, I think I've talked about this before, at UW, who was running the Law Society and Justice program at the time, which he founded, and asked McCann if he would support a program that helped people like Kevin get into college. And at the time, I was just thinking about getting people into UW. I mean, I'd only been in Washington State 5 years. I probably didn't even know there was a town called Walla Walla. I think I remotely knew there was a Spokane, but you know, like Wenatchee or all these places that have wonderful schools, I didn't know anything about them. So I was just thinking about UW, really. And Mike McCann was super responsive. And then Robin Hennis, who's still at admissions at UW, again, a couple blocks from here, Smiths Hall, although I'm sure she's not, I'm guessing she's not coming in. And and Mike and Robin was super supportive, and so we had a lunch at the UW Faculty Club. That's what it was back then. Now it's, and decided to start the program. And somewhere right about then, Kevin was telling me about the resident release program, which put prisoners, instead of going to work release like they do now if they're lucky, they prisoners would come out to the dorms at the University of Washington on the campus and be actually prisoners in this resident release program. And Kevin told me some of the names that had been really life-changing for him. Woody Hodge, who recently retired, and Fur Dario, and the guy who ran the resident release program, I forget his name, but and then the key thing was Fur Dario gave me several names, and one of the names was somebody who worked at the Office of Minority Affairs. And so I went over to Smiths Hall to OMA, and this guy, I don't know whether he looked at me and decided that I was wacko or I'm a former prisoner and it was a, you know, kind of something, a fad, and I'd forget about it in 2 weeks or something like that. And but he didn't have time for it. He was too busy. But he recommended me to the next office down the hall, which was Emil Petrie. And Emil is like, you know, in this town, there are a few icons, and Emil certainly has to be one of them. Some people would say Larry Gossett has been iconic in our history. Yeah, but and Emil and Larry know each other, and they were in the group. UW actually made a movie of Emil and Larry, and when there was no black student group at the University of Washington, I think Evans was governor, and these few black students took over the president's office at the University of Washington. They actually drove a bulldozer into a construction hall, did all these wonderful things, right? And I think Evans was going to call out the National Guard, but decided not to. And out of that, they ended up with a black student group. And extraordinarily ended up with a learning center that's just a couple blocks from Smiths Hall, so a couple blocks from where we're sitting, that if you were, and it was oriented to tutoring or working with people of color, but a white person could go in. If you were a student and you were having trouble with astronomy or physics or whatever, except for like Christmas Eve night or something, a couple nights a year, you could go into that place at 3 a.m. in a panic because you got a test the next day, and there'd be a PhD graduate student who was a brainiac there to coach you, right? And so that came out of Emil's activism when he was much younger than he is now. So he retired a couple years ago, and Emil was immediately on board, and so we started the planning for the program in August 23rd, 2005, and then finally March 29th, 2006, there was a meeting of 29 people. By then, we had a 29-person working committee, and there was a meeting at the University of Washington School of Law. And Emil was there, Robin Hennis was there, Eileen Robeson, who was in financial aid, was there, Roger Goodman, who I wouldn't give you 2 cents for now, was there, and Hong Tran was instrumental that day. She's to this day a felony defense attorney with the Defender Association Division of King County, and we voted, 29 people voted to unanimously to start the program, to incorporate it and seek tax exempt status. And Emil agreed to be the first chair of our board. And there's always a funny story that his office used to be, OMA used to be in Smiths Hall. Now it's in Mary Gates. And every once in a while, I would come out from our office in the central building, and Emil and I would go to lunch. And the first time we ever did it, so we're walking from Smiths Hall to the UW Faculty Club, right, which later became the University of Washington Club. And it used to take us an hour to get from his office to the faculty club because every other person we passed was grateful to Emil for something that he had done for them during their, you know, during their college years. I mean, really, it was, I thought I was walking with the Buddha or something, right? Or Zeus or God knows who, but it's like everybody worshiped him and loved him. And then you'd finally make it to the faculty club and get seated, and you couldn't eat because people kept coming by the table. It'd be like, almost like in the old days when Eldon Vale was secretary of the DOC, he and I had this fabulous back hall restaurant in Olympia, and we'd have to go to the back room because he was the secretary of the DOC. And if we sat out in the main room, then everybody would be coming by the table and you couldn't eat. And it was kind of like that with a meal, except for there was no back room that he and I could hide out in. And so it's just like one person after another coming by and paying their respects and expressing gratitude. So, but a meal that day, I can picture it. We asked him to be the initial chair, and he agreed, and he stood up and he spoke, and everything coalesced, and that's how the program started. So it was, there was people along the way, like if Mike McCann had responded negatively to my email to him after I met Kevin Allen, I probably would have quit. I wouldn't have gone to Robin Hennis. If I got a really negative response, like, oh, this will never work. His response was, this is going to be very difficult, but let's do it. And boy, was he right. Or if Ferdario had never given me Emil's, had never directed me to the Office of Minority Affairs. Or really, there was some hesitation during that March 29th, 2006 meeting about incorporating and seeking tax exempt status, and Hong Tran spoke up and carried the day. And so there was people all along the way that if they had been negative instead of positive, there'd be no post-prison education program, and Kevin Allen at the head of the list. So August 23rd, 2005 was a big deal, as far as I'm concerned. It was with a lot of memories. The newsletter that Hannah put together, that does have an introductory paragraph from me, that's on our Facebook page, and she's on personal leave for another week or two due to some real sadness in her family, and that'll end up in the blog section of our website, and there's some great links. One of the links is to an interview with Jarvis J. Masters, who's on death row at San Quentin, and I think I may have talked about this last time, and I don't know if the interview had happened yet or
what. No, it was going to. It was a week away.
Yeah. So what was really. So that's happened. That was extraordinary to be able to talk to somebody who has been locked up in San Quentin for 40 years and is done with his life what he's done with it. But it was like, so that's, there's a link to that interview also in that newsletter. And, it was pretty extraordinary. David Sheff is a famous author now. I think he became famous. He might have been well known and respected before he wrote Beautiful Boy, but when he wrote Beautiful Boy 10 years ago, and then when it became a movie, Amazon Studios turned it into a huge movie success in 2018, then David became really famous. And out of the blue, Weir Harmon, who's been the director of Town Hall since Town Hall came into existence. I think Weir was there when Paul Allen was putting up the bucks and they were putting the whole thing together. I think he's the original director. But Weir sent an email to me asking me if I would agree to interview David Sheff. And I was like instantly, oh, hell yes. I think all I did was hit reply all and put yes, 3 exclamation marks. Because I had read Beautiful Boy and I had seen the movie, which you can Netflix Beautiful Boy. It's the story of David's son becoming addicted to meth, and the battle. It was a 10-year battle to save Nick's life. Two of the amazing people I've met in the last couple of years, Pete Early, who wrote Crazy, who we had a town hall last October, and then David Sheff, has something very much in common. They're not quitters, and them not quitting saved their son's life. But both of their sons are doing well, because Pete didn't quit on his son and David didn't quit on his son. When Weir wrote and I asked if I'd do that interview, I was like honored, number one, and I was ecstatic, number two. And then I hadn't read Buddhist on Death Row. And then they wanted me to use earphones, which I never use. I answer most phone calls I answer on computers now. I don't hardly ever answer. Everything is WebEx in our world. WebEx meetings, WebEx Teams, WebEx calling. But I talk through the computer. But I had, fortunately, this brand new pair of Cisco earphones. And so I read the book, reread the book, was blown away, and then we did a tech call with Town Hall has amazing staff, and so we did a tech check, kind of a call with David, and is near San Francisco, and me at Green Lake, and Town Hall people spread, you know, also working from home and not in their building, and so David and I got to talk that day. And then 30 minutes before we went live on this crowdcast, Town Hall had David and I in what they call the green room. So all they had to do was click a button and we'd be live. But we were in the green room and we were able to talk for a half hour with Weir and Candace. During that time, I told him that what he had done with his son in Beautiful Boy just reminded me so much of Pete Early with his son. The last paragraph of Pete's book, Crazy, is just a heartbreaking phenomenal. I love it. He's got this, he goes through truths that he's learned. And the third truth was that basically you'll never quit. And so that I'll always be there for you, which to the greatest extent possible is a moral rule of the post-prison education program. I mean, there are things that applicants and students can do that will cause us to close the file, But to the extent that funding allows and that's our sort of motto, or that's our the rule we try to live by. You know, we're here for you. You know, relapse, we're still here. Psychotic breakdown, we're still here. Have something bad happen and your grades go to hell, we're still here. Drop out of school, we're still here. You know, so there's that truth in Pete's book that I've always admired, and he and David have that in common, which is kind of extraordinary because they're both really well-known authors. So anyway, so August 23rd, two Sundays ago, was our 15th anniversary, and the newsletter is on the Facebook page, and it's really worth reading. You know, if for Hannah's built a brand new website, and the link to that's there. And then the town hall YouTube of the Crowdcast, where I interviewed David and Jarvis, is that link is there. And it's just, it's amazing. It's you know, there's, it's amazing what to have somebody be able to call in from death row and, you know, and talk to us. And people were able to put a chat up, questions up at the end, which was really cool. So it could be, so Jarvis couldn't see those, David and I could see them, and Candace from Town Hall could see them, and Candace is the one who was putting them up. But we could read them to Jarvis, and a couple of them were just tear-jerking. I was like, there was two that I read to him that reading them brought me to tears. And then, but it was really extraordinary. And the state of California, that's supposed to be liberal, and the governor, who's supposed to be progressive, has allowed this man, who absolutely everyone knows is innocent, to be on death row for all these years. It's an outrage. So it's a really good interview, and I was honored, really, really, to be invited to do that. And David Sheff is just a sweetheart, loving guy and fabulous writer, and Jarvis the same. And so that's in that newsletter. And so we're on to the next 15. And I think the good news, you know, I put it in the newsletter for the first time in these 15 years, I think the nonprofit is at a place where I could die tomorrow and the program could survive. I mean, funders would have to get behind our current staff, but we've got really amazing people in the office now, you know, and I named them in the newsletter, so that's cool. And, you know, not wanting to be optimistic and upbeat through an entire interview on your show, Mike, I'm going to switch over to something that's very much on my mind.
Okay. I'm surprised the shift didn't come a little sooner.
So I wish I could name this guy so everybody could track him as he releases from the Department of Corrections. But there's a guy at the prison at Airway Heights who's returned to prison 7 times and on felony cases. I don't know how many misdemeanor cases he have. We have DOC data uploaded into our Salesforce, and so we can see in incarceration events for his record. We can see how his first incarceration was 1995. It's really sets the life. For 25 years, this guy has been in and out of prison, and it's all about mental illness. So we spend a lot of time an email from prisoners and JPay, which is another one of these goddamn for-profit companies taking advantage of prisoners
and their families.
And their families, exactly. And, you know, so GTL, Securus, JPay, I'm fine if somebody drops a nuclear bomb on their corporate headquarters. I might be dancing in the street with my first tequila since 1984. But anyway, we are constantly in JPay with prisoners. And this guy, as he's gotten closer to his release, has gotten really frantic. There's no other word. Frantic about getting us to be involved with him and to work for him when he releases. And the email, the JPay are psychotic. I mean, that's all that there's. You can, it's just obvious. So Taylor is receiving JPay from him. Lila is receiving more JPay than Taylor or I receive, but we're all three receiving tons of just desperate JPay from him, and he's not in touch with reality, or he's got such difficult issues, mental health issues, that his mind's just all over the place. So one day it's, I want to release to Moses Lake. It's the next day, if I release to Moses Lake, I'll obviously return to prison because every crime I ever had happened there, and every bad thing happened there, and every relapse happened. And one day it'll be, I just need a job. The next day it'll be, I want to get into school. And the differences are stark. And I've never done this before, but things were so bad. It was so clear in our office, and it is so clear in our office, that this guy needs help and probably needs to be on meds, that I reviewed all of his email to Taylor, all the ones that he's written to Lila, and all the ones he's written to me, and then I spent a couple days drafting a response. And we put it up in Google Docs, and we were very careful with it, and then we dropped it into a JPay and sent it to him. And then I sent a copy of that to the superintendent of the prison, James Key, and to Danielle Armbruster, who's assistant secretary in charge of reentry, and several other people in leadership at the Department of Corrections, asking, just letting them know this is where we're at with this guy, and we think he needs to be evaluated. So it was really, we'll see how this plays out, and I'm going to track it, and if it plays out the way I think, I'm going to do everything I can to get it on the front page of a newspaper. But so what they did was, they called this guy in for an evaluation. And you know, if you're going to be evaluated for schizoaffective disorder, which is not what I think his diagnosis is, I think his diagnosis is either bipolar or borderline personality, but I'm not a mental health professional. But we've sent his email to a mental health professional, and she was the one that suggested that that we asked to have him evaluated. But you can't do an evaluation as to whether somebody is suffering borderline personality disorder or bipolar. Walk into a medical room in a prison with somebody who's probably not qualified, answer a few questions. You know, did you rob the bank? No, I didn't. I didn't rob the bank. Are you mentally ill? Hell no, I'm not mentally ill, you know. Do you have any mental health? Oh, no. Do you use drugs? No, never. That's pretty much how I think the evaluation went. And I'm guessing it was made by somebody, and guessing is an emphasis, that it was made by somebody who isn't qualified. But we really quickly, like within a day, got an email back for the superintendent saying we've had him evaluated. Didn't say what the outcome was. But then the next thing we get is angry JPay from the prisoner. So it's clear that DOC was like, probably like the post-prison education program ratted you out and asked for this evaluation, you know, and so we've gotten way lengthy JPay from him, insisting he doesn't need to be on pills, you know, basically saying, well, now I know what you think of me, because he'd been told by DOC staff that we suggested the evaluation based on recommendation from a mental health provider who I really respect and know extremely well. And then again, begging for help. And so he's going to release between now and November 10th. He's going to release to his county of origin, which is just insane, Moses Lake. I don't care what you say. If there's one person that lives in Moses Lake that's not a Donald Trump supporter, I'd be surprised. But that's a conservative Republican, what I call a hater community. And there's no support there for a guy like this. And what's going to happen, again, is what's happened in the past. So, I mean, if DOC had acted responsibly to the letter we sent to them, they would have done a county of origin change and let him release to anywhere other than Moses Lake. And they would have made sure he releases to somewhere like Spokane or Seattle, where there's mental health providers that would give this guy a chance. But what's going to happen is it's really sad, and I feel bad about it. He is not on meds and not with mental health care providers involved. He's beyond our ability to help. You know, we can't successfully work for somebody that one day is going in this direction, the next day is work going in another direction. And so we're composing a kinder, kind, as gentle of a JPay as we can to let him know that we're not going to be involved, mm-hmm. you know, I think that's going to go out tomorrow. And so, you know, what's going to happen is, you know, he's going to come out and he's going to catch a new case and he's going to continue this life of incarceration, because this goddamn society from Jay Inslee on down and Steve Sinclair and Danielle Armbruster, who I talk to fairly regularly, the assistant secretary of in charge of reentry, and right on down to the superintendent and right on down to the guy's counselor, they're doing nothing to prepare this guy for a successful release. And he won't have a successful release. And we're not an entitlement. We're not DSHS. We don't have a multi-billion-dollar budget. I'm not Cheryl Strange. I can't dedicate staff to work for this guy. So I think it's going to be a horrible outcome. And the responsibility for that is at the feet of people who don't give a goddamn. And again, that's Inslee and Catherine Levers and Sonia Hallam and apparently Danielle Armbruster and James Key and everybody at Airway Heights who's working with this guy. And then everybody who's in Moses Lake where he'll release to. It's just, and we just see this a lot. And I've been seeing it for 15 years. And so like the turmoil in our office right now is that, I mean, we actually had lunch. We went to lunch yesterday. I just had a surgery Tuesday that was horrible, and I was feeling really bad yesterday. But the concern level for this guy was so great that I agreed to meet Lila and Taylor to talk this out. And so it's just that the normally we dive in. Normally we make commitments thinking maybe we can pull this out of our ass somehow, some way. And most often we do, miraculously. But this one is one where we just feel like there's no chance of us being able to work for him in a way where he can be successful. So we're backing out. And we're going to leave it to DOC and their community corrections officers who work for Mac Peavy, who I despise since he lied to me in a matter involving Wendy Hine. And we'll see what happens. And we'll follow it closely. So I don't know.
And just to be clear for people that might not be familiar, your organization regularly works with people that are coming out of prison that have mental health issues.
Yeah.
You appear to gravitate exactly towards that. People, yeah. The most challenging
yeah.
people.
Yeah, yeah. It's, one of the things that Crystal Liu is doing for us is taking our data and pulling it out of Salesforce and DOC records that we have and putting it into Tableau software, which paints pretty pictures. So it's super accurate, but it's, for a lot of people to look at a spreadsheet with all this data and stuff is numbers and data and, but if you put it in a really pretty bar graph, which Tableau software is really good at, make really nice narratives out of data, and then it just makes it more clear. So Crystal has confirmed what we already knew, and it's what you just said. It's I think I've talked about it on the program before. Since 2010, we have, by choice, gravitated towards people who suffer mental illness. And that was when it became clear through DOC data that maybe half of Washington's prisoners are designated by the DOC as suffering serious mental illness. We've criminalized mental illness. Like it or not, if you're okay with that, you're a hater, and I wish you dead, really. But if you're aware of it and you're not doing anything to fix it, then I wish you dead. Inslee, you at the head of the list, because he has the power. I mean, to take people who are born into poverty and suffer mental illness, to allow them to spend decades of their life in misery is so unconscionably wrong that I can't even put words to it. And so when we encountered this DOC data, starting in 2010, then I talked about it at Town Hall last October 9th. That's the reason we had Pete Early in from Washington, D.C. for that event, was to talk about mental. Then we started gravitating towards not helping anybody who's mentally healthy and helping only people who suffer mental illness. As of the 2016 study by UW as to the efficacy of the program, I think it was 74.23% of our applicants, so people who apply to the program, have been designated by the Department of Corrections as being high risk to recidivate. So that's an admissions criteria. And then once they get through the acceptance process that we have, it turns out that it's a larger percentage of people that we actually accept. So 78% of our actual students, as opposed to 74% of our applicants, are rated by the DOC as high risk to recidivate. Not low, not moderate. And then 48%, it could be 43 and I've forgotten, but I think it's 48% of that 78%, are S-code 2, 3, 4, or 5, which is the DOC designation for serious mental illness. And so we do, that is where we're at. And nobody's there but us. And I'm thrilled that we're there. I wish that 100% of the people we work with were high risk to recidivate, and 100% of them were also S code 2, 3, 4, or 5, suffering serious mental illness. And then I would be happy. Our recidivism, our students' rate of recidivism would presumably go down, but that's a choice that funders have. So when Rakes Foundation says, "Oh, we're only going to work with kids. We, by policy, we won't fund entities working for adult former prisoners." Same thing for Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and I won't even go there, you know. Seattle Foundation. If you ask Seattle Foundation to fund, Seal Erickson, I hope you're listening. I love you, but your foundation sucks. If you ask them to fund in meaningful dollars, helping adult former prisoners, who most often have children, by the way, that are suffering serious mental illness or not, they're a no-show. They're not going to show up, and they're not going to help. So if we had really substantial, meaningful funding, maybe our student success rate, which is 92.13%, spectacular, wouldn't go down. But presumably, if we were 100% working with people with a high risk to recidivate, and 100% of them suffering mental illness, it would go down somewhat, but maybe it would go from 92% to 80%. And so maybe 8 out of 10 people that didn't have a chance but for us would have a life, and really a good life. You're right. We are. That's where we're at, and we're there by choice, and I don't know what else to say about that. When I watch government, and a superintendent at the Department of Corrections, that's government, because the secretary of the DOC is head of a state agency on the governor's cabinet. That's government. Right down to this guy's counselor, that's government. So when government responds as poorly as they do, to great need, and we see it every day, I'm hopeless. You know, we've got a guy that just came out of prison after 9 years for a violation, a failed piss test, 9 years for a violation. And his CCO, who's at the DOC's West Seattle office, won't allow him to have a cell phone and won't allow him to have internet access. So Taylor's group has him registered to go to Bellevue College, and he would do extremely well there, but he can't go to school as it stands right now because the Department of Corrections won't allow him to have internet access. Will not. So, a lawyer now will take that back to the sentencing judge and try to get that changed. And maybe that will happen in time for him to start school this quarter, and maybe it won't. But for right now, and I called Danielle about this. She was actually on vacation in Montana, and sent her an email saying, "I want to talk," and we ended up talking about a week ago. And I went through the entire history of this, and then I wrote her a confirming email asking her to do what was necessary to reverse the action by the CCO out at the West Seattle office, and I haven't heard from her since. Not one peep. I didn't get a no, and I haven't got a yes, but, actions speak louder than words, and this young man can't use the internet. So he can't work in our office. We were going to have him in our office on work study because he would be fabulous coaching on people coming out of prison, what to do, what not to do, how to succeed, how not to succeed. So we can't have him in our office because we're internet up to our ears, and he can't do classes with Bellevue College because that's all remote internet. So they block, and really, you can't you cannot do anything in today's society without a smartphone and internet access. You can't. You can't buy a plane ticket. You can't get a Lyft. You can't order groceries. You can't apply for jobs.
And it's been amplified by the pandemic.
It's like amplified a million times over. And so what the CCO is doing is making certain this young man can't do anything but not put his life back together again. That's outrageous. It's outrageous. And we just see it every day. That's what we do. That's what Taylor's group does. That's what Applicant Student Services, a post-prison education program, does, is try to counter just horrible circumstances like we've been talking about in the last 20 minutes. I mean, I'm hopeless. I have no hope that it's going to get better. I mean, it amazed me walking in here today to see this major construction on the street between here and UW Bookstore. So, because it just, that's, you know, Durkin and Inslee and Dow Constantine and his little dilettante fancy shoes, they all, they can talk about, oh, there's no money for that. We'd love to take care of people who are homeless, suffering mental illness, but we have no money. It's not in the budget. The dollars aren't there. But they got the dollars to make wealthy people wealthier. And there's all these crazy construction programs going on. The bridge on Lander from 6th Avenue, where our office is, to 1st, where Starbucks headquarters is, has to have cost hundreds of millions of dollars. There was money for that. And it's just rich. The people who sell concrete, they're getting richer. Steel, they're getting richer. The wealthy are getting wealthier, and people that are suffering, are the level that they're suffering at is increasing. But there's money to have this out here on this street construction, major construction in front of my house on East Green Lake Way. There's money for all of that, but there's not money to take care of people and meet what I think is a societal obligation, you know, and I just wonder where all these people who have like no morals, no ethics, where they came from. You know, they're just like egocentric, and I really want to use the F word, but I won't, you know, but consider it having just been said. All these egocentric, you fill in the blank with an S on the end and an F on the front, and they just seem to be everywhere. You know, and it's so I don't know. It's not going to get better. I'm glad I'm 73 and 1 year closer to being in a box pushing up daisies out in North Seattle somewhere, because I don't want to see where this is going. It's miserable. It's too bad. I told Taylor the other day I would hate to be her age, because, you know, so she's 30 and life expectancy for a female is 88. So, you know, she could have to watch this world disintegrate in the ways that it's disintegrating for 50 more years plus 8. I mean, I couldn't bear it. I couldn't bear it. You know, I get, so I don't know. Ask me a question. Change the subject.
Despite all the hurdles that your organization and everyone else is facing, you continue to, in your struggle, do amazing work. I mean, it's still 15 years is still a major celebration of the amazing work that your organization has done. I mean, the people, just the few people that I've seen come through your organization and had the good fortune to meet and stuff are amazing stories.
Yeah.
And just mind-blowing, or so many folks who, you know, on those times when I'm thinking, oh, this is, you know, my particular life is really tough on me, and then you look at people that have gone through your program that are absolutely inspiring.
Yeah. And then you can look at people in government who've met them and know, as a matter of fact, what can be done at much less cost than what they're doing now, and just because of, you know, legislative cowardice, political expediency, just won't. And You know, when the UW study of our work was completed in 2016, there were 176 people that fit what you just described, that had been students of ours. So it's not a small number, 176 lives as of 4 years ago. And right now we're working with almost more people than we've ever worked with before. The highest number we ever had at level of service three was 53, where we're spending big bucks on, you know, heavily involved in somebody's life, paying out lots of money every month. And we're right at 50 right now. I mean, but 176 is a consequential number, and that was as of 4 years ago, and 92.13% of them were successful. And 78% of them, you know, had been rated by the DOC as high risk. And again, 48% of that 78% were suffering serious mental illness. And you know, so they, but they just won't, they won't fund it, you know. So it's just like, you know, every once in a while, we're just, this program has almost made me believe in God. Don't piss off everybody, but, you know, because every time I think we can't survive the next day for one funding issue or next, we do. And it's because some caring person steps in and, you know, a $20,000 check from a Googler or a $50,000 wire transfer from a Googler, or a $16,000 loan from somebody who sat here in this studio before because she knows us through her nephew who's deceased now. But something, or an unexpected grant, you know, will pop it, show up in the door, and we'll survive, you know. So sometimes I think God's strategy is to just torture the hell out of me and everybody associated with me that thinks the way I do, but not let the program go under, because she keeps saving it. it's just crazy. So we've got a fabulous development director, and if you click on the link in the newsletter, so Hannah put up three of the staff members' bios, me and Taylor and Lila. But there's a link to click through to the rest so you can see Crystal and Caitlin and Hannah herself. And Caitlin Lombardi was at ACLU Washington for 11 years and really knows what she's doing. And so we have some really large grant applications out on the $1 million range, and we're hopeful, and she's putting out really amazing work, you know. And if half of those are successful, then all the Roger Goodmans and Tim Ornsby's be damned. We'll survive, and we'll keep doing it. And someday we'll take the data and shove it up their, can I say that? Probably not. Shove it up their ass.
We'll find out.
All right.
Well, lawyers will be talking to your lawyers.
We have plenty.
Yeah. It's good because we don't have any. All right. We are just about out of time talking with Ari Cohn, founder and president of the Post-Prison Education Program. And again, you can find out more about their work on their Facebook page, which just search Post-Prison. It's a hyphen there, Post-Prison Education Program. And your fabulous new website is
postprisonedu.org. You can just Google Post-Prison Education Program. The first link that comes up is us.
You can.